in the matter of Goldhagen versus Passmiewicz. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Joseph Monaco of Monaco Law PC, representing the plaintiff appellant Monet Goldhagen.
Melissa Baxter of Rossetti and DeFoto, on behalf of NJAJ, New Jersey Association for Justice, appearing as amicus curiae.
Andrew Siegeltuck Lukoski, Brooklyn, on behalf of defendant respondent Susan Passmiewicz.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Monaco, please go ahead.
This is an appeal from a court order from the lower court, which granted defendants motion for summary judgment and denied plaintiffs cross motion for partial summary judgment on liability. So in the event that this court finds the favor of the plaintiff, this wanted to make sure that the cross motion is addressed on remand. The case was appealed to the Appellate Division, who affirmed the trial court's decision, and plaintiff asked for certification, and this court was kind enough to grant the certification. This case involves an appeal from a summary judgment motion, which means that the review is de novo, meaning that it just follows the Briel versus Guardian Light standard of viewing the evidence in favor of the non-moving party, determining whether there are no genuine issues of material fact, and then determining whether a rational jury could find in favor of the non-moving party. Plaintiff put forth two main issues at the trial level and at the appellate division level. One is that the dog bite statute should not have an exception, that the exception created in Reynolds Lancaster County Prison, known as the veterinarian rule, should not apply because the statute is plain on its face. And also because the Reynolds decision, if you read it carefully, it created an exception to an exception, meaning it created this veterinarian exception, but then it created an exception to that in the fact if the owner knows a dog is vicious and they materially withhold or misrepresent certain information regarding the dog's viciousness, then they are not entitled to the defense of principal assumption of their risk. And then the second area that was put forth, or the second issue put forth by plaintiff, was that even if this veterinarian exception applies, that she still is entitled to have her day in court under common law, principle of negligence, including the absolute liability previously put forth by the court before the statute, the dog bite statute was enacted in 1933. And I will start with the second argument, second point first. So in Reynolds, the court was addressing two underlying cases. A dog that was owned by a prison in Pennsylvania, Lancaster Prisons, was given to guard dog. And the dog eventually bites the owner of guard dog, and it bites, and the owner of guard dog is Reynolds. And the dog also bites a worker or independent contractor of guard dogs, Mr. Adams. So there's two underlying verdicts. And in that decision, the court, the appellate division, seems to have undertaken more of an academic endeavor than a practical one, because it creates this veterinarian exception. However, it doesn't apply it to the case, because in the case, there were two seven-figure verdicts, and they were both upheld under common law. And in regards to to Reynolds, who was the owner of guard dog, it's also a little confusing as to whether they followed the exception to the exception, meaning in Reynolds, the dog had bitten five people previously. The caretaker had filed a report with the prison that the dog has some type of mental issues and that it should no longer be a guard dog. And when they sold it or gave it to Guard Dogs, which is a company, like a private company, which I believe provides dogs for security companies, they basically said, you know, it had some issues, it had bitten someone on the arm once, but that was only because he was trying to break up a dog fight. And so they failed to disclose that the dog had 5 previous incidents of biting people. And like I said, and the caretaker believed the dog had some type of mental issues. So the court goes through this whole process talking about this veterinarian rule, but the court doesn't apply it because it upholds both verdicts. The verdict regarding the owner of Guard Dog, who only sued Lancaster Prison, that was based upon a common law misrepresentation of the true nature of the dog. And in regards to the caretaker of the dog, Mr. Abbott, who sued Guard Dog and the prison, they said that in regards to Guard Dog, that they failed to investigate, the owner of the Guard Dog failed to investigate the true nature of the dog. So both verdicts were upheld. Now, if you put that in the context of Ms. Goldhagen, in Ms. Goldhagen's case, she was bitten in the face severely by a dog who had previously been the owner in the face. And you know, if you go through the record, there's questions about exactly what Ms. Goldhagen knew. And if you look at the trial court's argument, and then ultimate decision that was placed on the record, you know, he focuses on Ms. Goldhagen's act, that she knew the dog had been a child, she knew the dog should be separated when they're fed. However, though, you know, that analysis is misplaced because—
Counsel, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you forget about Reynolds, forget about the California exception, do you agree that our comparative negligence statute would apply to this case?
Yes.
Okay. So in the event that your client was 50%, 51% negligent, she would not be entitled to a discovery. You concede that, correct?
Correct. If you hold there's an exception to the dog bite statute.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I just want to understand the contours of your position. Your position is that we should not be invoking some judicially created exception to the statute, that we should be applying our statutes to our statutes in terms of the defenses. Comparative negligence is okay with a dog bite statute, but we should not be creating some judicial exception. Is that your basic position?
No.
No?
Okay. I can clarify.
Go ahead.
The dog bite statute is plain, is very simple. It says if you're bitten by a dog, the owner is responsible if it happens in a public or private place. And there are no defenses to it. It's a strict liability statute.
No, that's what I was, I don't want to mislead.
Is it your position that the Comparative Negligence Act does not apply to a strict liability, claim?
Yes, that's correct.
Because strict comparative negligence applies to many strict liability claims. What's your basis for saying that a strict liability claim in this case is not subject to comparative negligence?
Because in this case, the exception that was created in Reynolds was primary assumption of the risk.
I'm sorry, let me be clear. I'm leaving aside Reynolds, okay? You're taking the position, I'm basing this on what you said in your brief, that the strict liability, that you are entitled to pursue a claim under the statute based on strict liability.
Correct? Yeah.
And I think you just told Justice Albin that comparative negligence would not apply to that claim.
Correct. The statute is silent on it.
And do you acknowledge that strict liability claims generally are subject to comparative negligence in other settings?
Well, the only difference, though, is in other settings, you're talking about, you know, the actions, say, a corporation or a person. Here, we're talking about a dog.
No, we're not talking about the fault of the dog here. The strict liability issue, the comparative negligence issue would be about the fault of the defendant versus the fault of the plaintiff.
Correct. But
dog's not a player in that. This is all
no, I agree. But that was my point.
So what's your basis for saying that comparative negligence would not apply to a strict liability claim under the statute when other strict liability claims in New Jersey are subject to comparative negligence?
I've handled dog bite cases over the years, and it was never an issue, a comparative negligence. The statute is very straightforward. Even the law before the statute with absolute liability.
Well, there may be many cases where there's no question and there's no, you know, the person's just walking down the street and does nothing and is bitten. There's no comparative negligence claim. But are you saying that as a matter of law, when a claim is brought under this statute, the defendant cannot assert comparative negligence as a defense?
Yes.
What's your basis for that?
Because it's a strict liability statute, and there's no case law on it. And as I was getting to before, normally you're comparing the conduct of two people, but here you're not.
The fact that somebody owns a dog. Now, the dog's conduct is not in the mix here.
I agree, but neither is the conduct of the owner. The fact that the owner only has to be the owner of the dog to be liable.
No, I understand that, but under comparative negligence, the conduct of the owner would be compared with the conduct of the plaintiff.
But the conduct of the owner is not an issue in the under the dog bite statute. You just have to.
Strict liability means that the owner is responsible. It doesn't negate the fact. Strict liability means that the owner is responsible. Has no defense. That doesn't mean that there isn't comparative negligence by the injured party. Many statutes, strict liability statutes, have that, even though it's not written into it. It's the way it works. The strict liability means, yes, the owner is liable regardless, because there's no liability analysis. However, that doesn't mean that the damages can't be reduced on a comparative negligence analysis. Many strict liability statutes have that in place. So you're talking about the owner. Yes, there's no analysis to the owner on a strict liability statute. The owner is liable. That doesn't mean the damages verdict can't be reduced by the comparative negligence of the other individual.
That issue was never raised in this case. It was never briefed at the lower court of the Appellate Division or here.
Briefed doesn't mean we can ignore the law.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
Did your adversary raise comparative negligence as a defense? We're seeing a nod from your adversary.
It never came up.
Well, it never came up in conversation. Is in the answer to the complaint, did your adversary assert comparative negligence?
I don't know the answer to that.
Let me see if I can throw you a lifeline.
Sure.
I'm not sure this is correct, but I'm going to throw it to you anyway. I take it it's your argument that the dog bite statute, as written, is an absolute liability statute to which comparative negligence is no defense. Is that your argument? It is not like a common law strict liability theory or other strict liability statutes which absolutely incorporate other defenses to common law liability. This is an absolute liability statute to which comparative negligence is not a defense. And if you fit within the statute, there's absolute liability. Is that your argument?
That's my argument, but my argument in this case also includes common law.
No, I understand. But as to the dog bite statute, your argument is that's an absolute liability statute. And if you satisfy it, you recover if you're injured.
Correct.
Okay. But that's different than your argument about common law liability for negligence or common law liability, strict liability, common law strict liability. To those, there are the defenses of comparative negligence.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
And
Mr. Monaco, I want to understand your position on the dog bite statute. Assuming your client had a stick, was poking the dog, taunting the dog, striking the dog, provoking the dog, and the dog bit your client. Your position is strict liability, no comparative negligence. That's it. I recover. Your position, correct?
Well, the case law says if you're poking the dog, then you're getting into an assumption of the risk issue.
I'm asking your position on that. I assumed, I thought you were arguing there's no assumption of the risk, no comparative negligence. So you heard my hypothetical. What is the result? And if you, so let me hear what the result is. And then I want to hear what your justification is for the result. Go ahead.
I mean, if he's poking the dog with a stick.
Poking, provoking, taunting, yes, and gets bit.
Well, I think the case law talks about that falls under primary assumption of the risk that the defendant no longer has a duty to you if you're instigating, if you're provoking the dog.
So you're arguing there are exceptions to the strict liability statute?
Yeah. As a primary assumption of the risk.
Primary assumption of the risk.
Right. Because then the duty escapes, then there's no duty to the defendant to you because you're
and you find this primary assumption of the risk under the common law and you're now applying it to this statute, but you're not willing to apply the comparative negligence statute to the statute. I'm trying to understand your position.
Well, there's primary assumption of the risk and there's secondary assumption of the risk. Primary assumption of the risk deals with the defendant's duty to the plaintiff. It doesn't deal with the plaintiff's actions.
So if you're now accepting this primary assumption of the risk, that seems to be the position of the defendant. They're saying that you're, as a dog groomer, okay, you're taking the dog, you're assuming the risk of the dog. You should know the risk of dogs. Dogs bite. That's one of their arguments. So you're now you're accepting this primary assumption of the risk?
Well, I believe there's a case on that. Well, actually, it might have predated the statute in the sense that when you are provoking the dog, you do gain some responsibility, but I think it comes in through you're negating the duty from the owner. And also,
doesn't that also predate the Comparative Negligence Act?
Correct.
The Comparative Negligence Act changed a lot in New Jersey. You agree with me that
many
of the old common law concepts of comparative negligence and contributory negligence, assumption of the risk, are subsumed in the Comparative Negligence Act, and the fact finder makes the determination. Correct.
Correct.
So what I'm reading the statute. I do not see anything suggesting that there can be no comparative negligence. The only thing that the statute seems to be doing is saying that there is liability regardless of the former viciousness of such dog or the owner's knowledge of such viciousness. And therefore, it seems to be abrogating some prior common law defenses that may have applied. But this, tell me where in the statute it says that no matter what the negligence of the plaintiff might be, there is no application of the Comparative Negligence Act, which, by the way, didn't exist.
It's silent on the issue, Your Honor.
And when we have strict liability causes of action in, for example, as you well know, product liability cases in which negligence is not, it doesn't have to be proven, and many of the defenses are unavailable, and yet comparative negligence governs those cases. As we sit here, I can't think of a strict liability claim that is not governed by comparative negligence. You tell me an example if you can.
I cannot, Your Honor. But also, okay, this issue only goes to the cross motion for partial summary judgment on liability.
Counsel, we have your position on comparative negligence. We understand your view. Okay. You lost. Summary judgment was entered against your client at the trial court level. because the trial court relied on Reynolds, and that was affirmed under the same theory by the appellate division. Why don't you tell us why, in your view, Reynolds and the exception that it affords should not apply?
Reynolds, the veterinarian exception shouldn't apply because in other situations, the legislature has enacted a statute that created this primary assumption of the risk. For example, if you're skiing or you're roller skating, the legislature has created it. In this case, only we have the Reynolds decision that creates this veterinarian rule, but they didn't rely on it in their decision. Both of the underlying verdicts, seven-figure verdicts, were upheld under common law. So it's very confusing. You know, you have this case that creates the veterinarian rule, but it has no effect on the outcome of the case. They upheld both verdicts under common law.
Can you address the argument that because the legislature was active in certain other spheres, roller skating, skiing, et cetera, that it would be reasonable to infer they didn't see a need to do that with respect to dog bites because of Reynolds?
Well, the dog bite statute was enacted in 1933, and I think Reynolds was from the 1990s. There was almost like a 60-year gap between the enactment of the statute and then the Reynolds decision. So that's a long period of time, but that's the set law, that there is no exception, that there is no veterinarian exception to the dog bite statute. And then to create it, it just creates confusion. I mean, the statute is to make it simpler to bring a claim. If somebody gets bitten by a dog, then you don't have to go through the process of proving negligence. And also under common law, you had to have scientific knowledge of the owner that the dog was vicious to a certain extent. So in this case, we have a woman, the defendant, who knew that the dog had bitten her in the face and given her 30 stitches, but she fails to disclose that. So if we rely on Reynolds, you're taking a situation where someone with knowledge of a vicious dog escapes liability. I mean, that's not what the dog statute is in place for. The dog statute is to make it simpler.
But that doesn't even go to your common law claims, right?
Oh, I agree.
So you're not saying, nobody's saying escapes liability.
Well, my client's case got dismissed. So she is escaping liability unless this court reinstates her claim. And also, I think if you look at the common law aspect of it, I don't think there was ever a comparative negligence analysis done, because it's never mentioned in the trial court's opinion that they're doing a comparative negligence analysis.
But wouldn't that would be done by the jury?
Correct. Correct. So well, not in this case. My client's case got dismissed.
No, I understand, but comparative negligence wouldn't be imposed or applied by the trial court. It would be applied by the fact finder, ultimately a jury, if the case were to go to a jury.
Correct.
Right?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct.
So you wouldn't expect to see a court on a summary judgment motion engaging in a comparative negligence claim analysis.
They did dismiss the case. We had a claim under the strict liability statute, and we had a common law negligence claim, and they were all dismissed. So the court did do indirectly a comparative negligence, because they talked about what the plaintiff, Ms. Goldhagen, did wrong, saying that she knew that the dog had bitten a child, supposedly. She was told, or there's notations in the worksheet, that the dog should be separated, and so she ignored that. So these are all issues of negligence.
So this came up on summary judgment. Did the court make a finding that even viewing all of the evidence, like most favorable to you, your client was more than 50% negligent and therefore dismissed your case? Was there any finding of that type?
No, the finding was more along the lines of, she knew enough that the dog was dangerous. more along lines of the assumption of risk issue. So there's never a comparative. In this case, a jury could decide that the defendant's conduct of withholding this material information that the dog had bitten her in the face is so egregious that it outweighs any perceived or deemed negligence of the plaintiff.
Now, so under the common law, one of the requirements, the elements is that you must prove that the plaintiff was negligent, correct?
For the defendant.
The defendant was negligent. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Defendant
was negligent. Correct? You need science here. You need knowledge.
Did the court make a finding that you failed to prove that?
No.
Not at all?
No. Well, Your Honor, in this case, the defendant knew that the dog was dangerous because it bit her in the face.
Well, yeah, but I'm just asking you, did the court make a finding that your client, you failed to prove on behalf of your client that the defendant was negligent? Because that's one of the requirements common law is supposed to strict liability, as I'm sure you'll agree with.
I do not believe so. I don't think a negligence analysis was done at the lower court level. I think any analysis regarding plaintiff's conduct was in the context of assumption of the risk.
I thought the judge had ruled that there had been a failure of proof and therefore that's why summary judgment was entered. Maybe I'm wrong.
I read it that, you know, he's following Reynolds. There's an assumption of risk issue or defense. And so the issue was, I think he was trying to get into the exception to the exception in Reynolds of what happens if somebody withholds certain information about the viciousness of a dog, but it's really not clear. There's never an analysis comparing the negligence of the defendant versus the negligence of the plaintiff.
Counsel,
and I think that's up to a jury, because like I said, I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
Go ahead. I stepped on Justice Fernandez-Vina as well, please. To round out your argument, can you identify for us a principled rule that should apply in these sorts of cases going forward and tell us the relief that you seek?
Well, the principal rule is that the strict liability statute should not be abolished by primary assumption of the risk. Now, if the court deems secondary assumption of the risk, which has been melded or merged into comparative negligence applies, that issue is never really, has not been briefed, and it wasn't really an issue that it was addressed at the lower court. So my position is that the granting of summary judgment in the favor of the defendant should be reversed, that the case should be remanded, and that the defendant should be held liable under the dog bite statute, strictly liable, and whether the issue of whether comparative negligence applies. I'm not sure if that gets addressed here or has to get addressed by the trial court.
Are you saying you don't have to go to a jury? You just put the statute in front of the judge? That's it? Liable?
Not if this court thinks that the comparative negligence statute applies. But
The part of your remedy is to send it back to the trial court and find them liable, right? Find the defendant liable.
Right. That was my remedy regarding the cross motion.
So you are you seeking a summary judgment in your favor?
Yes, I did file the motion for partial summary judgment.
I think we understand your position. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Baxter.
Morning, Your Honors. Again, my name is Melissa Baxter. May it please the court. I represent NJAJ and appearing amicus curiae. With regard to the certified question, does the strict liability dog bite statute have an assumption of the risk exception for independent contractors? I answer on behalf of NJAJ, no, it does not. In support of our position, we not only rely on the liberal interpretation of the dog bite statute, the absence of the assumption of risk or other such language from any statute or New Jersey code. We also rely and we implore the court today to strongly consider the unfavorable public policy considerations such an exception would have for independent contractors. Simply put, it just would not work in practice when taken to its logical extremes. it's not workable. In large part because when you place such a broad definition, like the definition of an independent contractor, and apply it to a broad field in our society, like the field of dog care, you are left with unjust results, inconsistent results, and possible undermining of the intent of the strict liability statute. For instance, on one end of the spectrum for independent contractors, you have individuals like veterinarians, veterinarian technicians that seem to fit very squarely within the definition or the confines of an independent contractor. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have inexperienced individuals, often young people, often people looking for a part-time job or their first job, who posts a local ad in the shopping center or grocery store, who gets paid to walk the neighbor's dog, a friend's dog, a coworker's dog, who don't have the experience and training that a veterinarian or technician has on the other end of the spectrum. And of course, then you have the people in between those two types of people, an essential gray area where you have people who have a little bit of training, but not a lot of training, some experience, but not enough. And when you have such an exception of the risk exception for independent contractors, we feel that that would cast too wide of a net over everyone, leaving the people on one end of the spectrum without recourse, those people the statute intended to protect. And I think this is what Reynolds overlooked when the court held or reasoned in coming to the decision.
So, counsel, what is your position if Reynolds applied merely to veterinarians and to dog groomers? What's your position?
My position is that there should not be an assumption of the risk exception, because ultimately, even if you try to apply it to veterinarians and to dog groomers, I think even in maybe not so much veterinarians, because there are certain sort of education and certifications that veterinarians need to go through to in order to become a certified.
Okay, is your position that assumption of the risk can never be invoked?
Correct.
Okay, so you heard the hypothetical I gave, the stick, the poking, the provoking, the taunting of the dog.
Yes.
And any liability is.
And that's where.
Is a plaintiff entitled to a recovery under those circumstances?
Under the scenario that Your Honor posed, that's where I would diverge from counsel's argument with regard to contributory or comparative negligence. I think that there shouldn't be primary assumption of the risk, but there should and there can be applied secondary assumption of the risk, also referred to as contributory or comparative negligence.
Okay, so your position is the comparative negligence statute would apply.
Correct.
But not Reynolds. Okay.
And in fact, that's part of what Reynolds talks about. It applies comparative negligence to the dog bite statute, and so did DeRobertis years before that. Correct? I mean, they do apply to the dog bite statute.
Yes, they do apply to the dog bite statute. However, the way that I read Reynolds was that if you are an independent contractor.
No, I'm not saying that's not part of it.
But okay. They
also basically pick up on what DeRobertis says, which is, there is comparative negligence under the dog bite statute. Dog bite statute doesn't say that.
Yes.
Your counsel for the plaintiff argues that it's an absolute liability statute, not a strict liability statute, unlike common law strict liability. But at least those two cases and others say you can apply comparative negligence under the dog bite statute, right? You don't disagree with that.
I do not disagree with that at all. I believe that comparative or contributory negligence can be implied and can be invoked by the defense as a valid defense to the strict liability dog bite statute. The other point that I wanted to bring up was not only would a assumption of the risk exception primary only cast too wide over net over all those who may be considered independent contractors, essentially those who care for dogs, but it also would force the lower courts to make fact-based determinations on whether those people on various ends of the spectrum fit within the definition of an independent contractor. And I think when a lower courts, the appellate court has done this in a couple of unpublished opinions, they look at the specific skill set of the plaintiff, of the claimant. Is this person working part-time? Is this person have experience? Did this person go to college? Did this person have extra knowledge in the care of dog, in the field of dog care? Was this person trained by an apprentice? Did it run a business? Are they getting paid? Was there a written contract or an oral contract? Does this person know the owner of the dog by way of a neighborhood relationship, or is it more business? And I think
if the legislature made an exception for all independent contractors that included perhaps the teenager in the neighborhood walking the dog, would you be arguing that that was somehow an inappropriate application of its discretion?
Correct. Yes,
I would. You would be arguing the legislature does not have the ability to make an exception for independent contractors.
Oh, if the legislature made that, yes. Yeah. No, if the legislature made that, they can absolutely make it. But I have not seen the legislature do that with regard to the dog bite statute. That we're
obviously the legislature with ski liability and a number of other things has
right.
has really reduced the potential of liability to almost nothing. But and you're not contesting that it can do that.
No. If the legislature makes a assumption of the risk exception for independent contractors, like it had and codified with regard to skiing, roller skating, horseback riding, and baseball spectating, absolutely, I believe the legislature can do that. It just has not in this particular case. But back to my argument that I was just on, if the courts are making these fact-based determinations with regard to a claimant or plaintiff's skill level, I think that takes that fact-based determination away from the jury and couldn't lead to inconsistent results. So what we have proposed is that, number one, we do recognize that a person's skill set, a plaintiff's skill set, experience, training, and education with regard to prior knowledge of general dog behavior is relevant when determining liability. But we believe that it is better suited to be analyzed by the jury at trial under the guise and the defense of contributory or comparative negligence. That way a jury can make fact-based determinations on whether the plaintiff fail to discharge or properly discharge their knowledge or skill set in handling or caring for the dog. I think this proposal—
Didn't that always go to a jury, counselor? Whenever there's an issue of fact about knowledge, that type of thing, or the defendant's actions or plaintiff's actions, shouldn't that always be decided by a jury, basically?
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. But I think that on top of issues with regard to knowledge and viciousness and stuff like that, the jury should also make fact-based determinations on a claimant's skill set as to whether they fail to discharge their duties in caring for the dog. And I think this strikes a fair balance because it allows the defense to argue basically, hey, the claimant has these types of skill sets, this knowledge, they have training with dog care. They know that this dog can bite when you're administering eardrops or whatever's going on. But it also doesn't step on the toes of the jury by allowing the court to make those fact-finding determinations. And it doesn't step on the toes of the legislature in their intent of enacting the strict liability dog bite statute.
Could a court on summary judgment find that as a matter of law, the negligence of the plaintiff exceeded the negligence of the defendant? Just an example, you're talking about veterinarian, someone says, please muzzle my dog. My dog has a history of biting. And the veterinarian or vet tech or whatever says, no, forget it. And there's a bite, for example.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree that a court can make that determination just like it has made that determination in summary judgment motions. In other cases and in other circumstances, from products liability to med mal cases to motor vehicle accidents, if using the summary judgment standard, they find and the facts support dismissal or summary judgment on behalf of one party, I think that certainly, but I think that—
And that would cover Justice Albin's example of someone harassing or prodding a dog potentially as well. I'm not asking you to comment on a particular situation. We're talking hypothetically. It's not what happened here, but
correct.
That could be a summary judgment case.
It could be. I don't think that my proposal, I'm not proposing that would be taken away from the court's ability. My position is that just imposing an assumption of the risk exception for independent contracts, a flat line rule is just too broad.
Other questions for Ms. Baxter, anyone? Anything you'd like to close on? I think we have your position. Good.
I believe you. You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Siegeltuck.
You know, since 1999, New Jersey appellate case law has recognized an exception under the dog bite statute for independent contractors under the Reynolds case. And I see there is no good reason to depart from that law today, particularly in light of the undisputed facts of this case. And I think that's important for us to focus on some of those facts right now so that we can understand why the court granted summary judgment using the exception in Reynolds. And so let me just very briefly remind the court of certain facts that led to the summary judgment ruling. We know that the plaintiff is a dog groomer and kennel assistant. She testified that she'd been a dog groomer for 20 years. She was taught by a master groomer. And in her words, she had taken care of thousands, that's her word, thousands of dogs. And she knew as an experienced dog handler, as everybody knows, that dogs sometimes bite. She also knew and testified that she needed to take precautions. She knew that some dogs may be passive at a particular time, they may become aggressive later. And she had seen, and these are her words, too many to count, too many of her coworkers bitten. Too many to count was her phrase. And I think the most important fact that I can remind the court of, and which is undisputed, and all of these facts, by the way, that I'm presenting to the court right now are from the plaintiff. These are entirely from the plaintiff. And here is her interrogatory answer, which is the most important piece of evidence in this case, I think, for purposes of reviewing the summary judgment that was granted. In answers to interrogatory, she said the following, and I'm quoting, this is a quote. Plaintiff was told by defendant that her dog had bitten her son before. She was also told that the dog needs a muzzle to have his nails clipped and that plaintiff would not get bitten if she did not clip his nails. That is her answer to interrogatory. That's her answer to interrogatory number 19. And in fact, I went over that with her in her deposition and she affirmed that answer and did not withdraw it. Now, she also testified about the fact that she had a protocol for feeding dogs. And as your honors will recall, this incident occurred while she was inside the kennel sitting between the two dogs, Louie, the big dog that bit her, and Otis, the smaller dog. And she said that her protocol, this is her testimony, was to put the food in the front corner of the cage and walk away. She also said that's the only protocol she uses to feed dogs. But in this case, as I just mentioned, she didn't follow her own protocol. She went inside, sat next to the dogs, and they weren't supposed to be fed together anyway. She knew that, or at least that information was conveyed to the kennel, and that's not in dispute. She sat next to them and violated her own procedure. So she didn't act reasonably with respect to her own knowledge about the dog. Now, it's hard to imagine how under any kind of scenario, whether we're talking about trying this under the dog bite statute or whether we're talking about prior common law theories like absolute liability, for example, under the Emmons case, how any reasonable juror, any reasonable fact finder could possibly come to the conclusion that this particular plaintiff didn't have all of the knowledge necessary to take precautions against the possibility of a dog bite. This was a trained, experienced person in the handling of dogs. It was a classic independent contractor scenario. And that's why Judge Porto in Atlantic County had granted summary judgment under the Reynolds exception. And to answer some of the earlier questions, he didn't feel it was necessary to go into a negligence analysis because he felt that it fell entirely within the Reynolds exception. And of course, we believe that the Reynolds exception makes good public policy. It's a rational rule. And as the court has, Justice Alben was talking about this notion of provoking the dog, and I think it's well established. You talk about the Foy case, the 1964 Foy case, the appellate division case, which established that exception to the statute regarding provoking a dog, which of course is a very, very reasonable exception. And of course, this court has engrafted exceptions to statutes on many occasions when it felt that the circumstances warranted it. So for those reasons, it's clear that there is no basis to overturn Reynolds. And I frankly haven't heard anything in the argument that suggested that there is a reasonable basis for returning it. Now, I know that the amicus has pointed to this notion of, well, you know, who is this exception supposed to cover? Well, it's obvious that the exception is not meant to apply to those who have only casual contact with dogs for compensation, like the occasional dog walker or somebody who agrees to feed somebody's dog while they're on vacation for some remuneration. We're talking about someone exactly like the plaintiff who's living, makes her living as a dog groomer and has been doing that for decades.
Since we're interpreting a statute, can we go back to the basics? Is there anything in the statute, in the plain language of the statute, that supports the exception?
Well, there's nothing in the language of the statute that says anything about an exception, but as I've already pointed out, there's an obvious exception that the courts have recognized for provoking a dog. And Reynolds has been good law since 1999. It's actually been followed, although the cases following it are unpublished opinions. There are at least three that I'm aware of that have actually followed Reynolds in the context of care, you know, dog groomers, kennel assistants, and so forth and so on. Here in New Jersey, I'm talking about.
So Reynolds is an appellate division decision. Is there any legislative history that would support the exception that Reynolds speaks to?
Legislative history, at least not that I could find, Judge, regarding this particular statute.
So typically in interpreting a statute, we look to the plain language. If it's unclear, we look to the legislative history. Why isn't that the end of the analysis in terms of engrafting the Reynolds exception?
Well, Your Honor, I can only point to Your Honor's dissent in the case of J.H. versus R&M Tagliarini, in which Your Honor actually went into a rather long discussion about just that fact that the New Jersey Supreme Court can, if it decides to, engraft exceptions to any statute. And of course, if the legislature doesn't like that, they can overturn it. And that's what Your Honor had written in that particular case. And I agree with that position. But there's nothing to prevent the Supreme Court from engrafting an exception or accepting an exception, which another court has already engrafted onto the statute, as we are dealing with here, when that particular exception makes, you know, good sense and represents sound public policy, as I believe it does here.
I'm not sure that Tagliarini was attempting to rewrite a statute. The dissent.
No, I agreed that it wasn't. My point was different. My point was that Your Honor had actually pointed out and listed situations where the court had engrafted exceptions to the statute. And your point there was, if the legislature does not like that, it always has the power to overrule it. So the engrafting of exceptions by this court is not unusual. It has the power to do it. And what we're asking that the court do today is to affirm the exception, a reasonable exception from Reynolds.
Didn't we, you're familiar with the Prospero case of this court? It's a case that deals with statutory interpretation. And we specifically said in that case that this court does not have the authority to engraft onto a statute words that were pointedly omitted by the legislature. So I'm trying to understand what gives the judiciary the authority to rewrite a statute?
Because sometimes it's necessary to, particularly in a situation like this one, where there's almost no legislative history, to carry forward the true intention of the statute. It couldn't have been the intention of the statute, as Your Honor pointed out, for example, to allow a situation under the statute or a claim to be made under the statute where the dog was provoked. So I think everyone recognizes that in fact is an exception. The courts recognize that it's an exception.
Well, that as you heard from the earlier exchange, that would be an exception under the Comparative Negligence Act. So, that would be the legislature having enacted a scheme that would address that without this court needing to import a judicial exception.
Well, as Justice Patterson was talking about, this is a strict liability statute, and it carries with it, as I understood what Justice Patterson was saying, that you still have the Comparative Negligence Act applicable to this statute. So if you look at it from that perspective, and this could be looked at as a species of that when we get to what we refer to as assumption of the risk, you know, as a sort of a sliding scale in terms of conduct, it's a perfect fit, I would say, with respect to those kinds of issues. And what I want to remind the court is that when we look at the facts of this case, and my concern here is for this case and for Susan Pasmowitz, who I represent, the facts are overwhelming with respect to what the plaintiff knew when she took control of the dog. And so however this is resolved in the court's mind, those facts would be facts that would not even have to be tried in my, I would assert. That's why summary judgment was granted by Judge Porto in the first place, because he recognized.
Is comparative negligence in your case? Is it been asserted?
We plead it as an affirmative defense. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Yes, is there a theory in your case that that the conduct of the plaintiff was so egregious that it breaks the chain of causation between any fault of your client and the result? Go
on, Your Honor. No, go on, Your Honor.
I didn't. And that therefore the court could find as a matter of law that your client is not liable.
Not sure if the trial court framed it in exactly those terms. I think the trial court essentially took the position, as we have taken the position, that the facts establish that she fell within the Reynolds exception because of the level of her knowledge, the level of her training, and the level of her experience. And since she was an employee of an independent contractor, it fell perfectly within this concept, that, which of course we can all recognize is related to the general concepts relating to landowner liability to independent contractors, because we know that there's an exception. And it really, in some senses, derives out of that notion.
Wasn't there some equivocation in your client's answers regarding she forgot that the dog had bitten her son and never told him, and she went back and forth when asked what she had told him or not? Doesn't that in and of itself preclude summary judgment and leave it to a jury determination as to whether the plaintiff's negligence was larger by 1% or whatever percent from the defendant? We have your argument today about what the defendant knew or didn't do and what she failed to do, but wasn't there some equivocation as to what your client said the instructions were, what she told him, what she didn't tell him? Doesn't that preclude summary judgment in and of itself? Shouldn't that be left to
a No, Your Honor, and I'll explain why. The actual situation, to be candid about it, was that the dog had previously bitten her, and she did not tell them that. But the plaintiff, in her answers to interrogatories, stated that she knew or had been told that the dog had bitten her son. So that's where the conflict is. But the important thing to remember is we're not here talking about facts. We're here talking about material facts for purposes of summary judgment.
Isn't the knowledge imparted to the defendant dog keeper or dog care part of the material issue of fact? If she told certain things, not other things, don't you think it's a material fact as to her ability to care for the dog and handle the dog? I'm not saying
no,
that
because
she doesn't overwhelm it, but shouldn't the jury decide that?
No, because the plaintiff, as I had read in the answer to interrogatories, it was as plain as day. It couldn't be more plain what the plaintiff said in her answer to interrogatory, which she confirmed in her deposition, where she said she knew that the dog had previously bitten. Now, there may be a dispute about who bit, whether the son was bitten or whether the defendant was bitten, but the operative knowledge admitted by the plaintiff and confirmed in her deposition was she knew the dog had previously bitten. And for someone in her position, who is an experienced, a very experienced dog handler, what else does a person in that scenario need to know in order to take precautions?
So did the trial court make the argument that you're advancing right now? Did the trial court make those findings just as you're presenting them to the court?
I don't know if they use the exact words that I've been using, but essentially, no,
so,
yes.
So what I'm trying to understand is, did the court just rely on the Reynolds exception as opposed to analyzing the matter under the comparative negligence statute?
Yes, it used the Reynolds exception, Your Honor.
So,
that's correct.
So if we were to accept your argument that the Reynolds exception, well, your argument, assume that we didn't accept the Reynolds exception, just for the sake of argument, would this case be appropriate for a remand for the court to consider it under the comparative negligence statute?
No, because again, the facts that we've presented are overwhelming. And even if you go backwards in time to you know, one of the cases that's always written up, even in the later cases, is Emmons versus Stevane, which is the absolute liability case. Even if you look at it from that perspective, even the Emmons case recognizes that it doesn't apply, those rules don't apply, where the independent contractor has knowledge of the dog's situation or its prior history. So however you slice it, these facts are fatal to the plaintiff's claim, whether you look upon it as a pure application of Reynolds or whether you look upon it as comparative negligence or whether you revert back to absolute liability, the result is going to be the same. And that's why we're here asking the court to affirm the appellate division.
Mr. Siegeltuck, looking at the record, it does seem to me that it's not as clear as you're indicating. So if it were to go back for, we're here on a summary judgment motion. It seems like there is some dispute with the facts. At times your client said she didn't remember everything she told them. Plaintiff doesn't remember everything she was told. And with regard to the son being bitten, I think the plaintiff indicated at one point that she was told that the son was nipped, which can have various definitions, and then later said bit. But your client never said, by the way, I was bitten pretty severely in the face and had to get 30 stitches or so. It being told that, you know, a dog nipped someone versus being told that the dog bit her very severely in the face, which required a lot of stitches, is a much different scenario, wouldn't you think?
Well, Your Honor, again, this goes back to my argument about the difference between facts and material facts for purposes of summary judgment. As I had read previously, and this is plaintiff's answers to interrogatories, and I'm quoting, plaintiff was told by defendant that her dog had bitten her son before. That's a statement by the plaintiff.
Do you think that's the only fact that should be considered in a summary judgment motion, where the facts should be construed and looked at in a light most favorable to the plaintiff? That's the only fact that should be considered?
Well, that's not the only fact, and I mentioned a number of other facts, but to me that's the primary material fact, because of the plaintiff's status as an independent contractor, knowledgeable and trained with dogs. Don't forget, the rest of the answer to interrogatory also says that she was told that if the dog had its nails clipped, it needed to be muzzled. Now, why do you muzzle a dog? You muzzle a dog so it doesn't bite.
But not under any other circumstances. She was told that if you were grooming the dog or bite or clipping the nails, the dog needed to be muzzled. And she said, well, I'm not doing that. So seemingly the dog wouldn't need to be muzzled otherwise, right? And I think your client said that in her deposition.
It tells you something about, and she talked about evaluating the dog and trying to learn the dog's personality. And that's an important piece of information. She knew that it was a large dog. She called it a 130-pound dog. She knew she wasn't supposed to sit inside the kennel with the dog, which is what she was doing at the time. There's a whole myriad of facts which come from the defendant. They come from the plaintiff. They don't come from the defendant. We're relying on the plaintiff's own statements, her own testimony, her own answers to interrogatories, and not relying in any way, shape, or form on the evidence of the defendant, because we're here trying to, for the very reason that Your Honor cited, which is we have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. But even when you do that, there are no favorable facts.
Please finish your argument. Go ahead.
Yeah, as we say, We support the application of the Reynolds exception. We believe it's rational public policy. We believe the court has the power to engraft.
But let me ask the question then, if that's all right. If the court doesn't accept that, if the court concludes that the Reynolds standard, which the trial court relied on, was not the correct standard, you're asking, and give guidance as to what the appropriate standard is, you're asking this court to be the ones to first apply that standard instead of sending it back to the trial court, which would be the ordinary course? Is that your position?
Yes. We would ask that this court affirm the decision of the appellate division applying the Reynolds exception, which was also applied by the trial court, and affirm the grant of summary judgment.
Yes, I'm asking you to assume that the court might go the other way for purposes of this question and not apply the Reynolds exception.
And even if the court looked upon it as a case which should be tried under the theory of, not the theory, but the defense of comparative negligence, that we still believe that the summary judgment should be affirmed for the reasons I've just described, based on the overwhelming facts, which suggest, even when viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, establish the knowledge of this individual who is a trained professional in this particular field.
And my question is, you would like this court to make that decision instead of the trial court, which ordinarily would. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor, because of the overwhelming facts as I've brought them to the court's attention with regard to the plaintiff's conduct and experience.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, Your Honor.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.